China would be happy to have Russia as a kind of vassal, as a servant, as a junior partner, if it can be convenient. But it wouldn't want to pay the costs that might come with supporting that servant, that junior partner in a relationship. So yeah, I think Russia needs China more than the other way around, as you say. It's a partnership of convenience, but it's absolutely united in its opposition to Western leadership.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal halvtime. My name is Mathilde Fasting, and today I'm joined by Bill Emmett. This is a podcast in our MPS series, where you will meet many lecturers who visit the MPS seminar in Oslo in October 2022. Bill Emmett is the former chief editor of The Economist, and he has written The Fate of the West, the battle to save the world's most successful political idea, and that was in 2017. Many things have happened since then, and we will discuss these things in the podcast and maybe also touch upon those things that you said in this book, because it has a quite strong title, The Fate of the West. But first of all, welcome, Bill.
Delighted to be with you, Mathilde.
We'll start with an overall question about classical liberalism and how important it is and why it is right and important to be a classical liberal in the time we are living through right now. And also, maybe you could define what you mean by classical liberalism, because that could be very different if you ask a person from Europe, from Norway, from the United States. So what are your impressions? What are your definition?
Well, I think that the fundamental point about liberalism, whether classical or otherwise, is that it captures many different ideas, but at the center of it is a basic belief in freedom. It's in the origin of the word, liberal. It's about freedom and about the freedom of individuals to act and to pursue their lives in as independent a way as possible, but also the benefit of freedom in a society to allow the society the flexibility, the adaptability to respond to changing circumstances, whether they're in politics or technology or the climate or other things. The more free the society, the more flexible it can be. Now, we know that in societies, that freedom needs to be governed by the state, by rules. We've known that since Adam Smith in the English language. We've known it since other writers in other languages. But since Adam Smith 300 years ago acknowledged the role of the state in making freedom possible. So let's not be dogmatic about the balance between the state and freedom. And that's really why liberalism varies so much, because the expression of that role of the state in making a society able to celebrate and enjoy freedom and flexibility varies from circumstance to circumstance, from era to era. Underneath it all, though, is or should be, in my opinion, a basic sense of humility, a basic sense that the point of celebrating freedom is that we don't know what the future holds. We are not able to plan our lives or our societies or our economies in a Soviet-type way because we don't know the future. We cannot do this. It's beyond our capability. It's not just because the Soviet Union's computers weren't good enough to compute the future. It was that it's inherently impossible. And that I think that the basis of liberalism should be, and classically always is, a resistance to dogmatic, fixed views about what is the right way to do things and what is the wrong way to do things, but also a humility about what the future will hold, the liberal society is one that's able to adapt to what the future throws at that society, to roll with the punches, as we might say, that might come from from the unpredictable nature of our world, but above all, is humble about not knowing what the life is going to be like in 2025 or 2030 or 2050, and thereby making the society more adaptable, more able to respond in that way, in a resilient but also adaptable way. So that's why I think, while I of course think that liberalism has always been the right approach, and indeed it's been the most successful approach in political and economic history. There's no doubt about that, really. Why now it's so important? Well, I think because we face so many uncertainties. Just in the last few years, the pandemic above all, and the impact of that has had, the war in Ukraine, the revival of Russian imperialism, this threat of use of nuclear weapons, the energy crisis, all essentially unpredictable, has changed the way in which we have to think about our economies, about our lives, about our societies. Before then, the evolution of the United States away from belief in multilateralism, multilateral institutions, away from a very internationalist view towards a more self-centered view that Donald Trump showed. That also was unpredictable in the sense that while we could expect that this might be one of the range of possibilities that could evolve, it wasn't possible to say that in 2016 this is what will happen. So I think the case for humility has been made yet again by the uncertainties that have hit us in the last few years.
What about our own responsibilities here? Because very often you hear freedom, and but freedom contains also a lot of other things. In order to be free, there are things on the personal level, not only on the state level, as we have been talking about right now. So what are your views on that? How should we understand freedom and, of course, the other side of it, responsibility and our own ambitions and also capabilities of being free?
Well, I think that we must know throughout our lives that we are social animals, that we are parts of a society, and that therefore our freedom depends on other people, depends on the society within which we operate and which we live. The definition of society varies over time depending on technology, travel, influence, integration. But to operate freely, we have to show respect for each other and for each other's interests. And I think that's what liberals have grappled with over the centuries. Where does my freedom end and start to fight with your freedom in the way that we behave towards one another? And I think that that's an eternal question, probably going back even to Greek philosophers. But it's one that has a different expression as times change and as both social expectations, technologies, opportunities change. But the questions are eternal. We have to understand and act in the knowledge that our freedom is not an absolute. It's something that is shared and therefore depends on other people. But the limit to it is that we don't believe with the Marxists that there's something, a freedom of consciousness that needs to be forced out of us through a dictatorship of the proletariat sort of thing. We don't think that it's something hidden that we don't understand. It's inherent in our social interactions with one another.
And also you use the word dogmatism, and to resist that, I think it's also a way of when things are uncertain as they are today, it is easy for people to feel that they want security, and security might somehow be coined with authoritarianism and with being, and you know, having a strong man, having a system that really takes care of this uncertainty for us. We don't have to think if somebody is organizing, but at the same time, you're losing freedom, liberalism. So what is, how should we recognize dogmatism around us? How could that be, for instance, in a liberal democracy? Could we have dogmatism there as well?
I think that one of the mistakes liberals have often made is becoming too dogmatic about what is the right solution whether it's to do with education systems or taxation or balances of rights, is doesn't matter. I think that liberals have often made the mistake of presenting their ideas as if they were absolute and proven and undebatable, rather than experimental. So all, to my mind, all ideas should be considered to be experimental. It's just that we have to try something in order then for it to be proven wrong. In my country, the United Kingdom, our government has just had a kind of crisis through a piece of dogmatism, in which a new prime minister and new government came into power at the beginning of September and presented as a dogmatic statement that Britain was a high-tax country. It will not grow economically unless it's a low-tax country, and therefore immediately we will lower taxes, even though we had no way of funding this tax cut. And as if this was a not debatable idea. Fortunately or unfortunately, that idea immediately had a debate with the financial markets. And the financial markets won, or at least have won for the time being, and forced a rethinking and forced at least a representation of the idea. But this behavior by the new British government was a form of liberal dogmatism. It said there's only one right way to achieve economic growth and social prosperity. It is this, and we must do it.
Yeah, so what you're saying is actually that dogmatism can also be a liberal dogmatism.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I don't think dogmatism is just a feature of authoritarian societies. It can also be liberals who say, absolutely, you have to run your tax policy in the following way, otherwise you will have a disaster. Well, maybe we have to treat our ideas as being experimental. In the spirit of scientists, of Karl Popper's theory of science, saying everything is merely an experiment waiting to be disproved or proved, and each proof is necessary before we move to the next stage. So that does resisting dogmatism and being humble, of course, cannot mean that you never do anything. You have to try things, but you have to, I think, have an attitude which says, I wait till I find the results of this, and when I find the results are not what I expect, I have to change.
Yeah.
And so, I think we have to see policy policy as a permanent set of experiments.
Okay, so well, go over to discuss the title of your paper. You prepared a paper for the MPS seminar, and that was called, as far as I could tell, "What We Know and Don't Know About the New Geopolitical and Economic Order." And you say, of course, that there are some things we might know about this order and that we can identify and respond to. But also, as someone who has followed world politics closely for so many years, I will have to say you started in The Economist in 1993. And
1980 I started.
1980, and
yes.
You both became chief editor
in 1993.
Well, then so many years.
I'm even older than I look.
The listeners can't see you, they just see the picture. So what about those things that are happening? Are you more cautious and insecure today about predicting than you were before, if you were more optimistic or more, should I say, secure before? I don't know, I think so, maybe. Have you been insecure all the time?
I think that there are times in my kind of professional career when I felt more secure about what I have thought of as being kind of broad, predictable trends that you could rely on, and thereby work out scenarios based on those predictable trends. I think we're in a time when there are no such predictable trends. Some might say, but you know that the rise of China and the emergence of superpower rivalry is a predictable trend, and that this will be the feature of the 21st century. Others might also say, yes, and we also know that demography is a predictable trend, that we know that population trends change only quite slowly. And therefore, we can look forward and say our societies are aging, that China's now aging. The only country where population will continue to grow is Africa, and make some assumptions based on that. But I think that, first of all, those are quite general frameworks and not really very useful for for making planning or making sort of serious predictions. But secondly, even those cannot fully be depended upon. If we had a war between the United States and China, what impact would that have on the future growth of China or on the US or even on demography? Big changes in demographic trends have happened thanks to major wars. So even that trend is not reliable. So I conclude currently with the pandemic, with the war in Ukraine, with the confrontation between the US and China, with the evolution of the United States, that we're in a period of particular uncertainty, which I like to call radical uncertainty, a term that goes back in kind of intellectual history into the 1920s and 1930s, but really just means the kind of uncertainty that you cannot make a calculation about probability on the basis of it. There are many things you can put probabilities on, but some of the big factors, you can't. And it's a mistake to try to, because you're probably then going to position yourself, your business, your country in a too rigid a way. So I think we are in a period of very radical uncertainty and a period in which, therefore, while predictions are not avoidable completely, they are not very useful. And that preparing ourselves not for specific outcomes, but rather in terms of our capabilities and our ability to change in response to whatever the world throws at us is more important.
I know that you are not the chief editor of The Economist anymore, but usually around New Year's Eve or New Year, it's very, very common also for people to have at least wishes, that's one thing, but then also to predict. Papers are full of predictions for the next year to come. And do you think these efforts are useless? And do you think they have some value at all? Because you say we can't predict. And of course, I know from economics that the beautiful but also very dangerous thing is that when you have this beautiful model working and it gives you an answer, when you have put on all the things into that model and it gives you something with two lines, this is the answer, then you feel kind of secure and you shouldn't. So is this the same thing about these predictions? And I'm not sure, and I can't remember even the Economist predictions for 2022, but I'm not sure if the war in Ukraine was there and
It's a good question. I should look back to see what they said.
What they said.
And the thing about that annual issue, which you say, which has been published now for probably 25 years, I think, every year, the world next year, essentially, is that most of the articles are based on things that we know are going to happen. An election in country X, the Olympic Games in country Y, those kinds of readily predictable kind of anchor events. And therefore, what it is an issue. Most of the articles of which are looking ahead at known facts, but then trying to say, well, how might this happen? What really will happen in this election or in this around these Olympic Games or whatever the known fact might be. But of course, looking ahead, there will be some predictions that are inherent in that. It's quite short term, and therefore I suppose one would defend it from that point of view. Although in publishing terms, I would point out that because its origin was always as a paper publication, most of the articles for it are written probably in
many weeks before.
June, July.
Even months before.
Of the year before. So the problem for that publication has always been that it might be out of date even before it's published, let alone next year. So it always had to be handled with quite a lot of care. But people enjoy reading it. I mean, I think if it's successful, that kind of exercise in prediction should be an exercise in making people think about.
Yeah.
What is coming, but also what are the possible range of outcomes.
Because then the learning ability and adaptation, which is, they are two words that you are using in your paper. Can you just explain a little bit more about how we should think about, I mean, it's obvious learning is learning. It's taking the knowledge that you think you could use somehow and put that into to things that you are thinking about or things that you want to do, and you use your knowledge to do that. But an adaption is, of course, if this happens, I just have to change my plans. I have to adapt, go into this or into that. How could we use history in a sense? Because this is history. It's what we have seen have happened, and then we are using it for the future. How can you explain, and how should we think about those two things, learning and adapting?
Well, I think it may be that the most interesting studies after the pandemic, and of course, most really deep scholarly studies are not made until some years afterwards because you need time for the information to come through, maybe about China and Japan and how those two countries responded to the pandemic. Why do I say that? Because I think that Japan's a country I know and love greatly, but definitely showed quite a deal of rigidity in response to the pandemic. Not total, because it too had to adapt to digital working, to changing organizational structures and behaviors in order to respond to the reality of COVID. But in its governmental processes and in the way in which also pharmaceuticals companies, for example, operated, it nevertheless got stuck in quite rigid behaviors and therefore lost time and indeed had some bad outcomes thanks to that rigidity in its kind of governmental structure and in its decision-making process.
Were you surprised?
No, I wasn't. I was surprised perhaps, though, by how long it took for the system to realize the damage that was being done by that rigidity. Now, if you go to China, I think, and scholars, when they look at China, what will be interesting is that in the early stages of the pandemic, with some justice, people, including liberals, looked on admiringly at China for its ability to make decisions, to be able to change policies dramatically in response to the new circumstances because of the centralization of decision-making, because of the lack of a need for consultation, so on. But actually, over the 2 years since the pandemic began, in fact, China's proven to have been remarkably rigid in some of its basic attitudes and policies, particularly the zero COVID policy, and its resistance to using foreign vaccines have been crucial. So the question I think scholars will need to answer is why was this the case? You know, it's a system in which seemingly the ability to build a new railway line or to decide on an airport here or to change your policy there. It was so much in the hands of a small group of people that they could make these decisions in a way that we as democracies found it more difficult. Why did they stick to that rigid system? Why did they not learn as a system about how to react to the way in which the pandemic had evolved? Stuck to their same policy as 2020, now in 2022, when the policy is clearly not working very well. And I think it will be interesting to understand what is it in the mentality of an authoritarian system which makes it rigid in those circumstances. Whereas I think, like liberal democracies, are pretty bad at making the early decisions. We have a learning process and an information absorption which can be slow because there are so many players, so many factors, so many groups, so many individuals that have to come to the realization. But eventually, actually, we've shown ourselves in this two-year period to be pretty adaptable and able to learn and change, maybe because we are so decentralized in our structures that we are sufficiently flexible to respond and react.
Let us just dig into China a little bit more, because when the pandemic came, information was kept in China. So, yes. I mean, there's still stories about what happened and where it came from. That's one thing that might say something about the system itself. And the other thing is that, as you rightly say, the zero COVID strategy that they are following, it's really, should I say, draconian measures for people, locking them in for weeks, months. You're not able to even go out and so forth. So it's really, you have to have a huge control system in order to make all people in a village or in a big city to stay and not see each other. And that says probably something about China as well. What are your thoughts on those two things?
Yes, I think that it's clear that in authoritarian societies, most often information is considered to be power and is part of a tool for the exercise of power. And therefore, these societies are intrinsically resistant to the dissemination of and distribution of information and allowing information to ripple through the system like waves on the sea. And that is probably an unavoidable and fundamental difference between an authoritarian society and a more liberal one, to do with the use of information. Information as instruction. Mm-hmm. Obviously, an authoritarian society can be very efficient at disseminating a simple instruction: zero COVID, lockdown, and then also work as a system to reinforce the capabilities in technology and in the deployment of security forces to enforce that instruction. So I think we've seen both of those characteristics played out in China. But then the final part of it, which is perhaps more surprising, is that the zero COVID policy really, from an outside point of view, looks like the elevation of a policy designed to demonstrate systemic superiority. In other words, a policy related to the relative position of China versus the West, other countries. So a policy adopted and pursued for reasons of international reputation, but keeping it and elevating it to such a position that it becomes blind to the actual conditions of society and how society is evolving. And that is surprising because the Chinese system, I mean, one debate that I think all of us have had about China over the last 20, 30 years is a debate about how sensitive is the Chinese decisions to public opinion. And very often those who are defenders of China have rightly pointed to cases where, even if it's not democracy, the leadership's decisions on some environmental issues, for example, or on policy after a disaster thanks to an earthquake or something like that, where buildings have collapsed that shouldn't have collapsed, that sort of thing, have shown sensitivity to public opinion because their own survival as a leadership depends on that sensitivity to public opinion. So why has this broken down or at least become less sensitive during the pandemic? I don't know what the answer is to that. And it will be interesting to see how that is explained as more information comes out, because the Chinese system seems to have, in a way, turned off the input to decision making, which was there before to some degree, which was some limit to how far you can push society, how far you can ignore public opinion, and. For the moment, there seems to have been a dialing down of that input into decision making.
Yeah, and when talking about it, I think that I don't really know, and I don't think I've read numbers of deaths in China that I really could trust. I'm not sure.
No.
So that's part of the information problem as well, because if you don't know, if you think it's no deaths, then the strategy is working. But if the number is really high, it's not working, but we don't really know the numbers.
No, that's right. I think we have to always mistrust data from authoritarian societies. There was a very interesting graphic in the latest issue of The Economist, which I did read, which was based on a paper by an academic, but which was using satellite data to look at the use of lights, I mean, of electric lights in societies, and using that as a proxy measure for economic activity, and comparing the evidence of light use with the evidence given by official GDP figures. And it shows a remarkably consistent gap in authoritarian societies between the official figures and the light-related figures, which I thought was fascinating.
Oh, that's fascinating. We have, of course, talked now a lot about the pandemic, and we will certainly come into the war in Ukraine as well. But you list a couple of things in your paper. You have unpreparedness, you have untrustworthy superpowers, you have a fragmented and leaderless global order, and so forth. So there are many things to discuss here. And I think we should continue a bit with China, because China now, we are in October, and soon there's this huge communist conference that will probably give the presidency another period. Maybe unlimited as we talk. I'm not sure, but this is unprecedented. Normally, he should have left his position and given it to somebody else. But in authoritarian regimes, this is always an Achilles heel, because we don't know who's going to follow in. My impression, and you'll have to comment on that, is that really right now it's very unclear who is going to come after Xi. And he's not that old either. He can last a couple of years to come, maybe a decade, we don't know. But what are your thoughts about that transition that's probably not coming now, because we know and think that he is going to continue? And what will that mean for China and the political system, you think? It's a huge question, though, but
it is a huge question, but it's a very interesting one. So my first observation about it should be that really the centralization of power in this one man and in the group around him, Xi Jinping, since he took power in 2012, has been a sign of weakness in the political system in China, a sign of vulnerability, or an internally perceived sense of vulnerability by the Communist Party leadership, vulnerability to corruption, especially, and to therefore the discrediting of the party, a vulnerability perhaps to rising power centers within China through the emergence of big companies, billionaires, the tech companies, especially Alibaba, Tencent, and others, vulnerability to the growth of the middle class and to their increased property interests and other interests. And you can react to that in two ways. You can react by liberalizing and accepting the dispersal of power, or you react by concentrating power in a reactionary way. And so I think that's what's happened. Mm. Now, it means that the primary argument that observers like me and others would use about the perpetuation of the party regime in China, which was that this wasn't any longer about individuals like Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai, it was now a system, a bureaucratic authoritarian system in which the bureaucracy had rules which said that, you as individuals will just be temporary occupants of the key roles in this bureaucracy and the system, that has now been abandoned, or at least for the time being, in favor of reversion to centralized personal power. So I think it's a reflection of problems, a reflection of weakness. It's an attempt to try to perpetuate, therefore, the role of the Communist Party, but in a personal way. But therefore, it's a high risk solution. Now, it means, yes, we don't know how long Xi Jinping will be there. He doesn't have a set of rules that govern him, but that doesn't mean that he's going to be there permanently because he will have rivals. This, every system like that generates...
Have you heard about any rivals yet? I haven't.
No.
No?
But that's because it's a very closed system. And when you have problems, then people generate their hostilities, their opportunities, their ideas that something should change. So I think we should see it as a reaction to weakness, but also it means that the system will become fragile again. That doesn't mean that we can predict when the rivals will emerge and the conflicts will happen within the Communist Party, but we know that they will at some stage, because now there's no automatic system, it becomes personal again. And so the only way to manage succession in such a system is through rivalry, is through essentially battles, even if they're nonviolent battles.
Yes.
So that it becomes fragile again.
Do you think there's anything in the Chinese, both economy or demography, of course, we know that the population, they are getting older and older, and also in technology and things. Are there any specific areas that we should especially look at when it comes to vulnerability of China? Do you see, you say, of course, centralizing, what you just said politically, that is a sign of weakness, even though the president thinks he can get all the power by himself and then he is strong because then he could decide. But we see it, and probably the whole system might crumble a little. We don't know, but China has been a bureaucracy and a state for so many thousand years, so it's not supposed to disappear. But what are... we could also bring in Taiwan here because that's a conflict that might mean something. But what do you think are the biggest weaknesses apart from Xi being president for another period that you see in China?
Well, one aspect I think that we should focus on, partly because we don't know yet in advance whether it'll be a weakness or a strength, is that a central part of policy and evolution of China in the last decade under Xi has been a move towards self-sufficiency and away from global integration. So China 10 years ago, or certainly 20 years ago, had a very high ratio of trade to GDP. It was very dependent on imports to then assemble into manufacturers to then export to Walmart in the United States or whatever. It actually, for the size of the economy, had an anomalously high level of trade. So it was very interconnected. It's fallen organically to something closer to a US-style level of role of trade in GDP, but also it's a matter of policy by Xi Jinping to produce. The Chinese system always produces these strange labels. Dual circulation is one of them in China. What does dual circulation mean?
Well,
actually, it means becoming more self-sufficient.
Okay.
It means shutting yourself off to some degree from dependencies on the rest of the world. Mm. That is not a stupid policy, because China can see basically in Russia's fate over the war
sanctions
in Ukraine,
things,
the way
yes.
in which sanctions have shown Russia's vulnerability and indeed its dependency on exports, but also the financial system and so on. So China, in the immediate term, probably are saying, dual circulation is absolutely the right thing to do. But then the question is, can China be strong as a disconnected?
Do they have the resources?
Do they have the resources, intellectual and otherwise? So they are a huge economy. They're a huge society. Potentially, among the societies in the world that could operate quite independently, China has to be high on the list. But what they also are is a system in which the Communist Party leadership does not want rival centers of power, is therefore put blockages on the ability of business and technology entrepreneurs to become too powerful. What impact does that have on innovation? There clearly are the state resources to pour into projects to stimulate innovation, but innovation is usually primarily driven by private initiative and enterprise and creativity. So my question about the future of China would be, yes, okay, it's making itself hopefully stronger in its sense by becoming more independent, by becoming less vulnerable to sanctions, by becoming more capable of making all of the things at high technology levels that it can do. But is its weakness that actually in doing so, it's cutting off the entrepreneurial spirit and enterprise that would like be liable to produce the quality of innovation that it needs? Currently, it's very vulnerable on semiconductors. We know that.
And talking about those, they are produced
in Taiwan.
In Taiwan.
Yes. And the machinery to make the advanced semiconductors is produced in the Netherlands. And China is not able to buy that machinery now. So that's a clear current vulnerability. And I'm sure that Xi Jinping and his team are working hard to try to find ways to overcome that vulnerability. Is this an incentive for China to seek to invade Taiwan? I think probably not, because it's pretty clear that in all at least imaginable scenarios, the semiconductor facilities in Taiwan would be destroyed, probably deliberately.
And innovation will mean bombing and destroying things.
Yes. So the captured Taiwan, the reabsorbed Taiwan, would not be the world's leading semiconductor maker after an invasion. So therefore, you are killing the very valuable, the golden goose, as we would say, that you are is your target. So I cannot see that as being a motive for invading Taiwan.
But should that hinder them then in doing it?
I think it does hinder them. I think it does. It's one cost that you, if you are Xi Jinping and you have a piece of paper and you're listing costs and costs, risks, benefits, it has to be among the costs and the risks that you are making your own economy vulnerable. You can build financial resilience if you are China. I think you can build your independent payment system. You can find ways to avoid some of the consequences that Russia has faced financially. But I don't think with technology that's as possible, and certainly not in some basic components.
So then let's see China then, and leaving China and just turning over to Russia, a neighbor, and seeing first that Russian-Sino-friendship relationship in this situation where we are now, because now Russia is on everyone's lips every day. And I have to admit that seeing Putin on the front pages all the time makes me turn the pages quickly. it's terrible to look at, and it's terrible to see what's happening over there in Ukraine. But right now, it's also a question how this relationship is going, those two powers, Putin and Xi, and what they are thinking about, and also how China has now been quite reluctant and quite careful in I wouldn't say taking position, because I would say that they are kind of floating a little bit to and from, and we're not really sure. So what are your thoughts on that relationship?
Well, my thoughts are that those two enormous countries are united by what they are against, which is Western leadership and domination. They are united by the desire to ensure that their countries are as free as possible to act as they wish, whether in the South China Sea or in the near abroad, as it used to be called, around Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and so forth. But they're not united in terms of any positive, constructive vision of the future. And it would be surprising if they were, because I don't think in history we've really seen two giant countries like they are uniting towards a common goal. Alliances or agreements between such large powers have typically been quite temporary phenomena in history. So I suspect that this is temporary, but of course it's significant because it is anti-Western. It's being tested by the war in Ukraine, because clearly the impact both directly out of prices on energy and food and other things on China is negative, even if they can get privileged cheap supplies from Russia under the partnership of some things, they're still more expensive than they would like them to be. They're not getting a free pass from this agreement. So it has a negative impact on them economically, but also I think it's losing them reputation and relationships around the world as well, that they would otherwise think that they should have it should be the time of their evolution where they were building a network of either sympathetic or dependent countries, and I suspect it's damaged them. So I think that the over the next 12 months, the partnership will be under quite a lot of strain.
Because, as you will say, put it in another way, the question is, do they need each other and who needs the one the most? I would suspect that China is less dependent on Russia than the other way around.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, China would be happy to have Russia as a kind of vassal, as a servant, as a junior partner, if it can be convenient. But it wouldn't want to pay the costs that might come with supporting that servant, that junior partner in a relationship. So, yeah, I think Russia needs China more than the other way around, as you say. It's a partnership of convenience, but it's absolutely united in its opposition to Western leadership.
We are, as I have mentioned a couple of times, talking in the beginning of October, which will, of course, reflect on the next question because it's about Russia and Ukraine. And it's, of course, at the time when we are speaking today, it's impossible to know how this war will end. Probably that is impossible in a couple of months, maybe years to come. We don't know. And we also don't know how long this conflict will prevail and be a war, a hot war as it is. But do you think that the Ukrainians stand a chance against Russia? And what is the situation in the West? Will we continue to support and support sufficiently? That's one question. And the other is, of course, the nuclear threat that's hanging over us. And we don't know what that might bring and if it's even coming to that Putin will use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. So we'll have to just dig into these very, very sinister and difficult questions.
I think the whole difficulty of the war in Ukraine is working out what an end will look like.
Yes.
And what victory could look like.
Will it look like, you think? And
I think that is hard. I definitely think that the political will of the West to support Ukraine has become stronger over time rather than weaker. Of course, it was made stronger by Ukraine's own political will and by Ukraine's initial success, which was helped by the West, but not as generously as the help that's come later. I think that there's no significant public opposition in the West to support for Ukraine, at least in the countries that matter, under current circumstances, which leads me to think that this Western political will should be expected, likelier than not, to last. Nothing is forever. So we'd have to put dates on that, which of course are impossible. But if we just look at this winter, in the Northern Hemisphere winter, I think the political will of the West can be depended upon to last and through into the spring. I think Ukraine is clearly making quite significant gains, pushing back the Russians. From a Russian point of view, in their conflicts historically, they've always considered the winter to be an ally, usually because their opponents, whether it's Germany or Napoleon, history have been less used to the winter than they have been.
Not now, I think.
But not now. They've got a more winter-hardened opponent. But they will probably be hoping that the winter will produce some sort of slowdown in the war. And then we will maybe only be able to judge it in February, March, April next year as the winter fades away. I think that the chances of a collapse of the Russian army or armies, really, because there seem to be different units, cannot be ruled out under the pressure that they are under and given the defeats that they are receiving. So that's an unpredictable phenomenon that could send things moving rapidly in one direction or another.
Because that's what we're seeing in small scale now, when the Russians are suddenly, you know, skipping everything and just running away. So
exactly, yeah. Yes, yeah, exactly. And that could, so we could produce, that could produce a sudden change.
In a bigger scale.
Yeah, on a bigger scale. Most likely we should expect that Russia would seek to consolidate and if you like, dig in again at on different lines, but you know currently they're in a state of some humiliation, and clearly they're losing. The total unpredictable point is what impact that has on the
Putin
and the security services circles around him that are the ruling elite of Russia, former KGB ruling elite. At some stage, he will be overthrown. But what stage that is, I don't know, of course. So there are various points that could be fragile, that could lead to sudden changes. What should we plan for? We probably have to think about a new stalemate at some stage that is not total victory for Ukraine, but then produces a new pressure from within the West for negotiations of some kind. And the question is, how will political will in the West supporting Ukraine deal with that new stalemate? For the moment, political will is strong, and indeed, I would suggest even some ways getting stronger. And I think through this energy crisis of the winter, it will also... That will not have an immediate impact, I think. But a new stalemate could start to challenge that political will, because the importance of Ukrainian success is that it makes the whole investment feel worthwhile and justifiable. Mm. So what happens when the success goes to a halt? That's perhaps the most difficult question about the Western side. Mm.
And about the nuclear, if that is being used, which can't be cancelled out, we have to think through that as well. Do you have any thoughts on reactions? It says, I've read somewhere that it won't be answered by nuclear weapons from the West, but there are other things that can be done. And do you think that is, of course, a risk of escalating things if that happens? But what are your thoughts? How should we prepare for that?
Well, I suppose my thought is that the only way one can think about it is by trying to think through the thinking in the White House and the Pentagon, mm-hmm. as to what kind of scenarios, if they thought through, and what would their reactions be. I think if what we're talking about is some form of battlefield nuclear weapon being used, this would be the beginning of the end of Russia as we know it, in the sense that I think that the response would be military, mm-hmm. because I think any occupant of the White House, in response to such an action, including at a time when Russia's clearly failing, it's where it. We are expecting a nuclear weapon because of Russia's failure. So it's a sign of weakness. In that environment, I think there would be a severe military response. As you say, probably non-nuclear, if it's been a battlefield nuclear weapon that's been used, but nevertheless really severe, that would then lead the war to accelerate further towards the Ukrainian victory, towards a Ukrainian success, to however you define it. Key question that is unpredictable is, what's the Chinese reaction? How do they think about that use of a nuclear weapon and about the NATO response? I don't think in these scenarios in which a nuclear weapon has been used because of Russian weakness and failure, China is not, I think, in those scenarios going to provide support for Russia. This is not like the Korean War, where Mao Zedong sent in millions of Chinese troops in order to save North Korea. The stakes for him, for Xi Jinping, are not like that in Korea. For China,
they are much more likelier to want basically to drop Russia or to persuade Russia to stop and to accept that Russia has been defeated. So I suppose my basic expectation is that the use of a nuclear weapon would be the beginning of the end of Putin and of the beginning of the end of the Russian war. Of course, there are dangers in the escalatory response and that we cannot discount, but I do think that the White House would order a significant military response. Mm. Anyone who thinks it's just some new sanctions, I think, are completely wrong. Mm. That's not just not conceivable, I think, from my point of view. But
yeah, it's and as you also said something that's going back to the U.S. and the White House, and you said it's probably going to be like that no matter who is in the White House. And we know who the person is right now.
Right.
And the elections are getting closer. And, well, not thinking about the coming up midterm elections, but the it's only 2 years until the next presidential election. And what is at stake, you think? And will they avoid giving Trump a second chance? Or how should they avoid it, if you agree on that kind of question?
It's easier to predict what's at stake than it is to predict...
Well, let's take that first then.
Yeah, exactly. I think what's at stake is the integrity of the American democratic system. Mm. Because too much of the Trumpian parts of the Republican Party... seem to have taken the conclusion from the defeat in 2020 and the failure to overthrow the defeat that they need to rig the system in their favor next time, which I think then starts to destroy the American democratic system or make it so polarized and that it would damage the society quite severely. So that is what at stake is the continuance of what we think of as the American democratic system. Now, can we predict how Trump, you know, and the handling of Trump and how it will evolve? Very hard. Hmm. If he got into, well, one, we have to remember that he's never won an election in terms of the popular vote. He's lost the popular vote twice. But of course, it's not the popular vote that decides it. But nevertheless, he has lost it twice. I think he's actually in a weak position right now, thanks to the investigations. Yeah. But he's a supermarketer. He's a very successful campaigner. So we cannot rule out that he could turn that to his advantage and come back. If you make me bet, I would bet that he won't.
Okay.
But is that a prediction? It's not safe.
No, it's a bet. It's a wish.
It's a bit. It's exactly. It's a wish. I think he won't. But it's so. It's in a way terrible that we are even worrying about it.
Yeah, I can agree. and Europe again. We have a couple of important countries in Europe as well. And you have just said, I will have to say to the listeners, if you want to know what you think about this coming freezing winter and the energy situation, you could listen to the breakfast meeting where you told us that you're quite optimistic in the sense of having enough energy and capabilities of supplying energy in Europe as such. I think that is the conclusion. You have to arrest me if it's not. But going to some important countries, we can briefly touch upon Italy and the situation there after Meloni has won and her coalition with the right-wing populist parties, we should say, now are governing in Europe or in Italy, sorry. And then Germany, which is a very important country that we haven't touched upon at all, but which is also an important country when it comes to both energy and the war in Ukraine and also the position of the country in the European Union. So maybe we should start with Germany, because I could say you can have some comments on Italy as well, but I'll ask the listeners to log into the Civita breakfast and have your comments there as well. Go for Germany.
I find Germany quite hard, a hard country to interpret. In some ways harder than Italy, even though Italy is sort of famously impenetrable, its politics, but actually they're a fascinating piece of theater usually. And the fundamentals are not so strange, usually, once you dig behind. Whereas in Germany, I find it quite hard to interpret. Now, I mean, the classic issue with Germany is whether it can come to terms with its own strength and its own significance in some ways. And I think we see that in its current debate and behavior over energy. So from the point of view of other member states of the European Union, there is Germany blocking a common European a European policy to cap the price of energy and to support households and businesses, and then announcing its own incredibly generous 200 billion euro plan to do so in its own country. So it's denying others who don't have the resources the opportunity to do what itself is doing. So what does this do? Well, it makes it increases some resentment of, as it were, the economic superpower of Europe. That doesn't mean, I think, that Germany is a malign influence, but I think it's always going to be so so much more powerful than other countries that it needs to be more careful in its use of its own power. But also, what hasn't happened sufficiently, and perhaps against the idealistic hopes of pro-Europeans, is that it hasn't integrated its domestic thinking with a pan-European vision. And I suspect it won't in the near future either, because there's a lack of trust by Germany of too many other countries in a 27-country organization. But nevertheless, that clash between the strength of Germany and its impact on other countries seems kind of permanent. You'd have thought that Germany and Poland would be very united by the common threat in Ukraine. Actually, they seem to be hostile to each other more now than they were 6 months ago. I think it's because of that kind of sense of resentment. So can Germany, if you like, mature its domestic behavior to become more conscious of the impact of its own decisions elsewhere? I suspect it's kind of too deeply ingrained in modern German life that you operate for your domestic interests and you don't seek to dominate Europe, that maybe it can't change. So there's probably going to be some friction always around Germany. Will it continue as a supporter of the war in Ukraine? Yes. I think that there's a clear political consensus on that. Will it build up its defense in the way that Olaf Scholz said he would in the Zeitenwende? I think yes, but quite slowly, because we're all facing choices in how we use our public resources. And you can make many promises, but you can't deliver on all of them simultaneously. And I suspect that they'll be slower than the initial kind of shock effect of the 2%.
Yeah, that's GDP. February speech.
Exactly.
And then talking about the neighbor, because Eastern Europe also as a bloc, and of course, there are many countries in Eastern Europe. It's not like Africa. Africa is also a continent with a lot of countries. And we tend to say Eastern Europe and thinking about it as a bloc and as a whole. But you have Poland, of course. And there are many things to be said about Poland. And at least before the war in Ukraine, things were like... quite often negative things said about Poland, especially the ruling party and what's going on there and so forth, liberal freedoms and so forth. But now Poland is one of the countries, together with Lithuania and Latvia and Estonia, being very, very clear about what Russian domination would be. And what that means, and why we should avoid it at any costs, almost. So, how do you think that view of the Polish people, and also maybe some of the other countries along the borders to Russia and to Belarus and to Ukraine, is it more important for them than for the Western parts of Europe to win or to have Ukraine successful because they are afraid of what's going to happen if not?
I think it absolutely is part of, it's an existential issue for Poland. I think Poland historically clearly is very conscious of the fact that it's constantly been invaded from either east or west during its modern history, always vulnerable. Its land borders have changed countless times in history. And I think that it's absolutely knows that that it's so close to Ukraine, indeed it's bordering Ukraine, that a war in Ukraine is a war essentially in Poland. And which, of course, is the identical feeling of the much smaller Baltic states of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. They are on the front line. And they're on the front line not only because of refugees, but because of they are within range of the
everything
yeah. of the imperial ambitions of Russia. So it is existential for them. I think it probably is going to change our view of Poland in a sort of positive direction, probably outside that part of Europe. Poland perhaps has been colored too much by our knowledge of Hungary and of the association within the European Union, at least, of Poland with Hungary as being the troublemakers and the anti-rule of law and anti-democratic countries of Central and Eastern Europe. And I think we're perhaps seeing that was, well, they're not wrong entirely on Poland. It was exaggerated. It was a bit unfair in that they haven't at all been able to or wanted to, maybe, but anyway, been able to go as far as Viktor Orban has done in Hungary. So I think maybe an emergence from the conflict of Ukraine will be the ability to see Poland as a separate case to Hungary. As a massive entity in its own right, a major European power, a major European economy, major European society, one that's played a pretty big and valuable role in the war in Ukraine. Mm. So I think maybe it's the beginning of a bit of an increased role for Poland within European Union affairs. Mm. I know that's certainly something that the pro-Brexit groups in the UK have always fantasized about. They've always wanted Poland to be their friend. They've been embarrassed about Hungary being their friend, but they've always really wanted it to be Poland. And this is partly a wartime nostalgia issue, to be honest. But also, I think they've always thought that Poland probably thinks more like the UK than France or Germany. Well. So they'll probably be happy by this.
I have tried to avoid questions about your own country. You are actually living in Dublin, so you are actually a European Union member country where you live. But you said UK, so we know that the rest of UK is not. But I try to avoid talking about Brexit and talking about the European Union now. But
I'm glad I might have cried.
I know that. I know at least the Economist's position on the Brexit votes, and we won't bring that into this conversation. We're coming to an end, and I'll just have the question about going back to the original start of our conversation about liberalism. And of course, it's a question where we can reflect. You can't answer it, but I would like you to have some thoughts about how liberalism will prevail in the future, and if that is equal to the West prevailing. Liberalism and the West, are they so closely connected so that if the West is not prevailing in with its liberal democracy systems, then liberalism will not prevail?
I think that liberalism and the West are very closely related. They're not obviously identical, but they are very closely related because the countries of the West, in which I think nowadays most of us include Japan, even though it's in the East.
It is East, but it's West.
But it's West. And there would be some other liberal democracies of Asia and elsewhere. I think they are united in their need to defend the principles of liberalism and of the exercise of liberalism around the world. If the world descended back into an imperialistic form, which of course was originally a European triumph, unfortunately, in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries and beyond, then
both the West and liberalism would be basically defeated and dead, and that would be a huge loss, I think, to the world, but especially to us, of course. So the problem for liberals is always persuading publics to fight to defend liberalism. Mm. This essence of liberalism is that it's a non-conflictual set of ideas. It's an idea, set of ideas that are about preventing conflict, about diffusing conflict, about dispersing power. And therefore, it's only in very extreme cases that that you need to galvanize your society and your people to fight for those values. Clearly, that's happened in the past, particularly during the Second World War. I think the war in Ukraine and the revival of Russian imperialism and questions about China and its extraterritorial ambitions mean that we need to do that again, and that galvanizing liberals to fight for liberalism, whether intellectually, economically, or militarily, is now a vital part of fighting for a prosperous and stable future in the 21st century. Mm. So, of course, the powers of the West are the powers that have the resources to be able to pursue that fight, and therefore that fuses back together again with the idea of liberalism. But the principal object is shared between all our societies, which is to persuade ourselves, to persuade our people that we really need to fight to defend these values by all means.
Do you think that Europe will be able to do that fight alone in case the Americans and the US will vote for that president that we didn't want to think about, if they retract and if they're not really defending liberal democracy anymore? How important is the US in this?
I think the US is absolutely central to it. I can envision circumstances in which the US turned illiberal and hostile and yet would remain an ally. Mm. Of course, that is possible, but it would not be dependable. It would be very hard to kind of make plans and think along those lines of an illiberal part of the West and a liberal part of the West. So I think that it would put in great danger the whole liberal idea.
Mm. If people not reading, of course, they should read The Economist, even though you're not working for them anymore. But
I'm a shareholder, so I guess I can benefit.
Okay. There are, I think you could just give the listeners the address of or the internet page or the blog or whatever you are doing. You have a place where you are writing things.
That's very kind. I write for a number of publications around the world, for an Italian newspaper, La Stampa, for two Japanese ones. I often write for Project Syndicate. And I like, though, to distribute those articles in their original English originals on a Substack newsletter called Bill Emmett's Global View. In addition, I write some articles specially for Substack when I just feel so agitated and annoyed by something. When a bee is buzzing around in my brain, I still write it on Substack, and then it goes to my newsletter followers. So please sign up; it's free. And I absolutely just want to disseminate ideas and exchange ideas.
Do you have any plans for writing more books?
I always want to write more books. I think I may write a book about, like, keeping the peace in the Indo-Pacific, about dealing with the issues around China and the balance of the superpowers in the Indo-Pacific. That probably is my next book. I have been working on ideas for a book on Italy, related to the use of European money and whether it might change the political paradigm, the political framework, over time as it passes through different governments. So that's a longer term project, but I've been studying how the Draghi government behaves, and now I will study how the Meloni government behaves.
And finally, I'm sure you haven't prepared for this, but on top of your mind, what are you reading yourself?
Oh, well, I read voraciously on newspapers and publications of all kinds. In terms of books, I do read quite a lot about Asia and about China, about the history of China, the history of the way in which these countries relate to one another, because I feel it's not a part of the world I know enough about. Even though I know a lot about Japan, I don't know enough about it, and it constantly worries me. So I very often read history books about China.
A good thing, then. I think the listeners should look at your internet page, maybe sign up for your newsletter and read your articles. And it has been a pleasure to talk to you today, Bill. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, Matilda.
And if you like Liberal Halvtimme, you can rate us and recommend us or give us feedback using matilda@civita.no or my colleague eirik@civita.no. Information about Civita is available on our homepage. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Liberal Halvtimme. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita. Moderne medier.